morning. Thank you very much for coming out this morning, the first of this year's Medical Halacha series with, yes, CME credit and a few thank yous. First of all, I want to thank Qualicare for sponsoring the series once again. And specifically, I'm going to single out Andrea because also Andrea is receiving a much-deserved honor at the AISH dinner on December 9th as part of a program to honor physicians. And I think that, number one, I think honoring physicians is always a good idea, particularly if they're your physician. But in general, it's good to honor physicians.
And nurses.
I'm sorry. Quite correct. I'm in the back of my head, I'm trying to get the word right. It's not medical professional, but it's very similar. Healthcare professionals. Thank you, healthcare professionals. Okay. But that's one thank you. A second thank you to Dr. Kirshen once again for taking care of all of the logistics of making sure that our classes this year would have credit. And to everybody who submitted their thoughts on topics for the year, thank you very much. We're planning three or four, I'm not sure exactly yet, sessions for this year here at the Bayit. An additional four at Shari Shamayim as well. We're also going to have the dental series going on with a few classes in the dental series. So this is going to be a fun year, God willing. I'm going to reiterate also what Dr. Kirshen said about filling out the online survey, the evaluation. I have to tell you, the Shari Shamayim group is doing much better in terms of the rate of fill-ins of the evaluation. So you need to hold up Thornhill pride. Granted, not everyone here is from Thornhill, but nonetheless. So as always, I proceed what I'm going to say. There are chairs up front if there's a need for more chairs. I'm going to proceed what I say by saying that for practical questions, please ask your shul rabbi. The shul rabbi should be the one who is setting policy for the community. I'm going to discuss halachic issues. I'm going to bring you halachic sources. But at the end of the day, it's really the shul rabbi who should be giving you practical guidance. So we're dealing with three cases, as I put in the email. All under the rubric of enabling patients to sin. The first is, oh, I'm sorry, one more thank you. Bayit Adult Education co-sponsored this series, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank Melech Tannen and Elaine Genesov for their help in setting this up, getting the room, and generally being very encouraging. So thank you to them as well. The three cases are, number one, giving contraceptive information to unmarried patients. Number two, referring a patient for a surgery that halacha would not approve of, a vasectomy, an abortion. You can come up with your own scenario. And then third, actually aiding in an act which Jewish law would have problems with. I gave one example, being an anesthesiologist during an abortion, perhaps offering marriage counseling for an interfaith couple. So these are complicated cases, no surprise, but I think we can define certain principles that will help us approach these situations. Now, inevitably, when you talk about enabling someone to sin, recognize that this requires a judgment on our part. In other words, I am now sitting as judge of what somebody else is doing. I've decided that what they're doing is wrong. That's a very dangerous game, deciding that I'm going to judge somebody else, and it's not one that we take lightly. Nonetheless, we are stuck in the sense that the Torah demands, to a certain extent, that one make a judgment of the conduct of others, usually insofar as our own conduct. How does it influence me, rather than because I'm supposed to tell people what to do? However, we recognize that there is a mitzvah of tochacha. The mitzvah of tochacha, literally translated usually as rebuke or demonstrate, is that if I see someone doing something that in fact is inappropriate, I am supposed to let them know. Now, is that always true? Is that true in all scenarios? Is it true if I'm not sure they will listen to me? Is it true where they would violate it anyway? And so there's much to discuss on that front. But our premise walking in is that even though judging others' actions is a very dangerous game and can lead to all sorts of problems, nonetheless, there is an expectation within the Torah, it's biblical verses, that I am indeed supposed to try to help people do that which I believe the Torah says they are supposed to do. That is coupled with a second point, which I bring you in source number one on your sheets, a sentence from the Torah from Parashas Kedoshim. Lo sikalel cheresh, do not curse the deaf, v'lifnei iver lo sitein mershol, and do not put a stumbling block before the blind. Ani Hashem, you shall revere Hashem, you shall revere God, I am God. This is a biblical instruction not to put a stumbling block before the blind. That could be taken on one level as being very literal. That you see somebody who is walking along the road and you put something in the way and it makes them trip, that's a bad thing to do. If you take a look at source number two, you find rabbinic commentary on it in the form of the Midrash, in the Sifra 2, that Parsha of Kedoshim. If someone asks you for advice, do not give him inappropriate advice. Don't tell him, hey, go out for your trip. He asks you, you know, when's a good time for me to make this journey? Oh, go in the early morning, knowing full well that then thieves will be able to attack him. Or go out at noon, so that he'll be overcome by heat. Don't give him advice that is bad for him. And that's a very literal form of lifnei iver, not to make somebody stumble. But we go even beyond that. When we talk about what one ought not to do, lest it cause somebody to stumble. Take a look at source number three for a very interesting example. He says, don't buy the following items off of a shepherd. Don't buy goats or kids, baby goats. Don't buy gizin or tlushin shel tzemer, wool or tufts of wool from shepherds. What's the concern?
Stolen.
They might be stolen. The way a shepherd operated, I realize that many of us are not shepherd experts. However, classically, the way that shepherds operated was not that they came to your house in the morning and they took your sheep and they went out and then in the evening, right, they brought your sheep back. The phrase is when the cows come home, not when the sheep come home. They would actually take the sheep for months and months at a time. And this allows them license, hypothetically, to take advantage of their possession of your sheep. They can take the wool and cut it and sell it to somebody. They could take the animal that the sheep gave birth to and then try to sell it to somebody else. And then when the owner gets the sheep back months later, they'll say, oh, something happened to the young. Or they'll say, yeah, the wool was no good. So you're not supposed to buy certain items from a shepherd out of concern that the shepherd might, in fact, have stolen them. That's point number one. Aval, whereas the Gemara there, the Talmud there continues, Avalokhin mehen tefurin, you would be allowed to purchase stitched clothing from them, finished goods, mipnei shehen shalohen, because you can assume that that's actually theirs. We're assuming that he's a shepherd, not a tailor. So we have less concern about the shepherd potentially having stolen that. Avalokhin mehen chalav ugevina bamidbar velo biyishuv, and if they're out in the wild, you are allowed to buy milk and cheese from them, but not in urban areas. And the idea here is that the shepherd generally has an arrangement with the owner of the animals that the shepherd is allowed to use the milk from the animals. The reason simply being that you're not going to expect the shepherd to hold on to the milk until they bring the goats back. It doesn't make any sense. So contractually, they were generally licensed to use the milk if they were out in the wild. The owner wasn't expecting to get the milk back. But the point for us out of this is, I'm not supposed to buy stolen goods. One might have thought this has to do with a prohibition against theft. But actually, the way this is codified in Jewish law is that it's because you're encouraging a thief. In other words, he's the one who stole it. You are not the thief of these goods. The reason why I am not supposed to buy the stolen goods is because I'm going to encourage him. I'm assuming it's a male. It's because I am going to encourage him to steal. So here we see that lifnei iver, the prohibition against causing someone to stumble, is not limited to the very simple and direct case of giving somebody bad advice. It even applies potentially to a scenario of doing something without directly telling him anything, like buying something from him that's going to encourage him to do something inappropriate. So that means that I have two mitzvos, two laws that I need to be concerned with. Number one, the law of telling other people what they ought to do, which maybe some of us excel at, but telling other people what they ought to do. And then number two, the concern of don't do things that are going to cause other people to stumble. So if I were to stop at this point, what would you say was the answer for, let's take our first case, which is, I think, the simplest one. Giving contraceptive information to an unmarried patient. What would you say, based on what we've said so far? You'd say no. Jack says, it sounds like we have a prohibition against giving that kind of information. So I'm going to tell you right now that the answer for all three cases probably is going to end up being mutter, that you're allowed to. The question now is, well, in the face of what we just said, that we have a mitzvah of tell people the right way, so to speak, and of don't cause people to stumble, how do the halachic authorities end up saying that these things are permitted? So that's what we have to cover for the next 45 or so minutes. Leah.
I would have thought that's such a complicated issue, like giving contraceptive advice, for example. I would have thought that the rabbin would say you have to take it on a case-by-case basis, because there's so many factors.
And there indeed are many factors that have to be weighed in. What I'm going to give are generalities, but I think that they actually do cover the cases. You'll see. We'll have to talk it through. You may be able to suggest nuances that will have to cause us to revise this. Jonathan?
Just also to distinguish between the issues between Jews and non-Jews.
Correct. Jonathan points out that halacha, Jewish law, is not necessarily the same when you're dealing with a non-Jewish patient. So the truth of the matter is, it won't be the same in the sense that the laws that bind them are different from the laws that bind us. We have 613 and they've got 7. However, the prohibition against causing someone to stumble applies whether it's causing a Jew to stumble or causing a non-Jew to stumble. I'm just as prohibited from telling a non-Jew something that's going to cause him to do something inappropriate. Yes?
Could be a proportion of harm the two ways.
Meaning?
So you give him no advice. They get pregnant. Child is born out of wedlock.
Right.
You give them advice, and they stick together with the baby, and they decide to get married.
Right.
So that may well be the ethical compromise.
Right. That's very good. There is a huge level of complication that you have to add to this set of cases, which is the law of unintended consequences. Right. Sometimes those may be positive. You didn't give them advice that allowed them to go on living their single lifestyle, right? And then they got married. That may be a happy ending, right? The unhappy potential ending is you don't give them the advice, they don't properly use contraceptives, they end up with a child that they're not able to handle, and the results of that can be catastrophe. So the unintended consequences can actually work both ways. So we have to weigh that when we deal with this as well. I posted one of our sources. It's going to be source number 11 on my blog last week to see what people's reaction would be to that. And you'll see it when we get to it, but it's basically a position saying you're not allowed to offer the contraceptive information. And there were a lot of people who commented on that saying, well, then what are you going to do when the baby's born? This is not simple, and it's not simple and straightforward.
You don't want to be named after yourself.
Right.
It also has to do with katana,
meaning?
Well, if they're ability to mental competence.
Competence and capacity. Oh boy. Yes. Then we can get into a whole other field of trouble. Okay, so I will note that due to my own bad timing, I have a program at 10 in the Robinson Taub Hall. All women are invited. It's a Midrashat Yom Rishon program for women, 2 great classes, one by Rabbi Weber and one by Adam Freiberg. But it means that I'm going to need to move along a little bit, even though there's more that we could say just to set the stage for this. So the question of giving this information, we said now that we have 2 potential prohibitions or 2 potential imperatives not to give them the contraceptive information. 1, the mitzvah of tochacha, of instructing people, and 2, the prohibition against causing people to stumble. However, that won't necessarily apply here for a very good reason, which I'm sure many people here are thinking, which is, if they don't get the information from you, they're going to get it somewhere. It's not as though contraceptive information is now closely held. So if you take a look at source number 4, you find the Talmud dealing with this. The Gemara says, V'chi is lei, Chavzid the Isura in the Hebrew is my own addition. The bracketed words are words that I added just to make the sentence read more clearly to someone who's not in the middle of that Talmudic discussion. But the chi islay, lo avar mishum lifne iver lo sitein michshol. The Talmud asks, because a preceding line that I didn't bring here seems to indicate that if there is somebody who already owns a prohibited item, there is no prohibition against me offering such an item to that person. They had it anyway. And the Talmud asks, is that really true? That if the person over there already has a prohibited item, there's nothing wrong with me extending such an item to him? But Tanya, but I have a source that says, Amar Rabbi Nassan, Rabbi Nassan said, Minayin shalo yoshit adam kos shal yayin lenazir, ve'evrim en hachay livnei noach. Rabbi Nassan said, how do you know that I am not allowed to extend a cup of wine to a nazir? A nazir is someone who took a vow, among other things, not to drink wine. So I'm not supposed to give him a cup of wine to drink. Ve'evrim en hachay livnei noach, or a part taken from a live animal to a Noachide, right? We talked about whether it applies to a non-Jew. This is proof positive that it does. One of the Noachide laws is that if they're going to eat meat, the meat has to come from the animal only after the animal is dead. So what if I have a piece of meat that was taken from the animal while the animal was still alive, and there's someone who isn't Jewish? Am I allowed to extend that meat to him? How do you know, he says, that you're not allowed to do it? Tamul lomar v'lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, because the Torah says, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. So the Gemara says, v'ha'acha d'chi lo yehavinon le shakli ihu. Ukaver mishum lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. Even if I don't give it to him, he's going to take it, right? You have your nazir standing here. There's a cup of wine on the table. He wants a cup of wine. If I don't pick up the wine and give it to him, he's going to take it himself. And yet it's still prohibited. So why is it that you say that where someone already owns a prohibited item, I'm allowed to give it to him? This source seems to contradict it. To which the Gemara explains, Haha b'mayaskinan, what are we talking about here? Dekai betray ivret nahara. It's where they're actually on two different sides of a river. In other words, if the prohibited item is on one side of a river, and the person who shouldn't be receiving it is on the other side of the river, I am not allowed to extend it across the river to him, because he has no access to it without my help. Whereas, if they're on the same side of the river, there's absolutely nothing wrong with me giving it to him, because if he wants it, he's going to pick it up and take it anyway. So the question is, am I really enabling the person to sin? Am I really causing the person to stumble? Or would it have happened without me anyway? And the Gemara says, you can see it in the wording that was used in Rabbi Natan's statement, Deka Nami, you can prove this. You can see this. How? Diktani lo yoshit. Because Rabbi Natan said, what you're not allowed to do is to extend the item to him, indicating that you're passing it over a distance. Not simply lo yitain, that you shouldn't give it to him. So the upshot of this passage in the Gemara is that if the item is accessible to the person anyway, or in our case, the information is accessible to the person anyway, we're okay with the idea that you enabled. That doesn't bother us, because ultimately that person would have been enabled anyway. Clear? So if you take a look at source number 5, at the Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Isserles codifies this in the Ashkenazi gloss to the Code of Jewish Law, to the Shulchan Aruch. Yesh Omrim, he says, some say, Had asr limkor lahem dvarim hashayachim la'avodasam, haynu davka im ein lahem acherim kayotze bo, oshlo yuchlo liknos b'makom acher. He says, regarding a separate question, there's someone who isn't Jewish who worships some god that I consider to be idolatry. Am I allowed to sell him what he needs for his idol? Or is that lifnei iver? So he says, of course it's lifnei iver. You're causing him to stumble by providing the means for this idol worship. But the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, says, some say that prohibition applies only if they don't have others that they could use, or they can't get others to use. Aval im yecholim liknos b'makom acher, but if they could get it somewhere else, Mutalim kolam kol davar, you could sell them whatever, anything that they might need. Then he says, v'yesh machmirin, but some are strict. Surprise. The nagu lahakel kisvara harishona, but the practice, he says, is to be lenient and follow the permissive view. V'chol bal nefesh yachmir la'atzmo, and if a person is a strong spirit, so he can be strict for himself, that's fine. And indeed, this is brought by various halachic authorities. The Chelkas Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Breish, I think his last name is, discusses this in terms of owning vending machines that are open on Shabbos. So do I have to worry that I'm enabling a Jew to go buy from the vending machines on Shabbos? So he says, no, because if they don't go to your vending machine, they're going to go to another vending machine. Someone who wants a candy bar doesn't stop because your vending machine wasn't in operation. It's discussed as well by the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. He talks about doing a medical exam on a pregnant woman where the results might lead to an abortion. And we're talking about an abortion that's not a, there are abortions that are halachically acceptable, there are those that are not. So we're talking about one that's not halachically acceptable. He says that's not a problem, because ultimately if you don't do the exam, they're going to find someone else to do the exam. It's not as though you're the sole person who's able to do a medical exam on a pregnant woman. So that's the core statement which might permit this. I should note, though, there are three possible limitations to this permission. Limitation number one comes from a comment in Rashi. Take a look, please, at source number six. Source number six, I'm going to say it outside of the text. You can read it inside, but in the interest of time, I'll say it outside of the text. Source number six is a Mishnah in which we discuss the problem of a woman who has a sifter, a sieve, a mill, something, and her friend asks her to lend it. And the problem is that the friend is suspected of violating the laws of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, in which you're not supposed to work the land and you're not supposed to harvest some of the harvest in that year. And so, by lending her this, you're going to help her to process the grain that was obtained illegally. So, the Mishnah here says, you're allowed to lend her the equipment, but you can't use it with her. And then it concludes, all that we permit, the permission we give of, go ahead, you may lend it out, is intended to promote peace. It's Dargei Shalom. In other words, because there's something to be gained by doing this, which is that we believe in the value of a peaceful society in which people get along, therefore you are licensed to lend out that piece of equipment to your friend. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so happy about it. But only because there's a potential gain. So it appears. Take a look at Rashi in source number 7. When this Mishnah is quoted in the Gemara in Gittin, Rashi comments there, V'chulan lo amru, she'itiru l'hashilam kelim u'lesayam belo sha'as avera atzma, el v'pnei darkei shalom. The only reason why we permit lending out the implements and even aiding them when they're not performing the actual sin, that's its own point which we're going to come back to, God willing. The whole permission that we extend for that is, m'pnei darkei shalom, is to pursue peace. It's for the sake of that benefit. And this leads some to suggest that the permission of Trey Ibrid of Chadibra Denara, of saying, well, you know what, he would have gotten it anyway, because he was close to the item anyway, that permission applies only if there's something else to be gained by giving them that information. Not where it's value neutral, but only if there's something to be gained. Now, something to be gained might be keeping your job. Right, you might get fired for not doing this. You might be lose your license for failing to give that. That would qualify as something to be gained. So that's one potential limitation. Yes.
Financial gain
would count.
Even
financial gain would seem to qualify as a gain that would justify it. The assumption is that people need money in order to survive, and that we don't look at that as a selfish desire, the desire to survive. We don't look at it as being something that's going to be just about himself. He's going to use it for good causes. Yeah, I would think. Nonetheless, it's actually brought as a potential justifying gain, even where it's a financial gain. Certainly where it's to prevent financial loss. We distinguish between the two. But that, in fact, is actually brought at times. The second possible limitation on this is based on our understanding of what of equal availability means. Meaning, we're talking about it being available anyway via some other means besides my own, right? Well, the Chavos Yair, Rabbi Yair Bachrach, dealt with a complicated case. He said he had the following situation. A Jew had some kind of a business arrangement going with someone who wasn't Jewish. And he owed the person who wasn't Jewish money. The Jew was a butcher. So he dealt with animals that were shechted, that were slaughtered for kosher consumption. However, the back part of the animal was not usable. There is a prohibition against using the sciatic neurovascular bundle of the animal, the gid hanasha, and the areas around it that are in the hindquarters of the animal. So the hindquarters are basically not usable unless you want to put in the expense and get trained in the expertise of how to draw out the parts that are prohibited, called trabering. You're not using the rear part of the animal. So he was giving it to the non-Jew, which is fine. It's kosher for the non-Jew. The prohibition against gid hanasha is for Jews specifically. Specifically, that was fine until the day when the non-Jew married a Jewish woman. And now the problem was that he is providing non-kosher meat for this Jewish woman. And so the question is he allowed to continue to do so? So as part of his discussion of this case, the Chavos Yair says, the only time when you're allowed to say, well, they would have gotten it anyway, as I would be inclined to say regarding this woman who's getting the non-kosher meat, she's going to find it somewhere. But the only way that you can say that is if what they were going to get was actually of equivalent quantity, availability, and cost. Right? Imagine the following scenario, to get away from the more complicated case. Simple case. There is a Jew here, and he has non-kosher options. But what I'm going to give him is actually of higher quality. Or what I'm going to give him is free, and the other ones he would have had to buy. So is it really true that you can say, well, he had other options? Maybe he wouldn't have wanted those other options because they're not as good as mine, or because they're expensive. Whereas what I'm giving to him is cheaper. So it could be that, going back to our medical case, if the advice that I'm going to give is actually going to be not better in terms of quality, because that's not germane here, but if maybe, you know, they're more comfortable going to me and they wouldn't necessarily go to somebody else, maybe that limits my right to convey the information. Because maybe if they didn't get it from me, they wouldn't get it from someone else and they would actually be abstinent. Now, again, we're living in the year 2013. The likelihood of this in application is slim. But nonetheless, I raise that as a potential question. There was a hand here? Okay. That's a second potential limitation. And then the third potential limitation is, what if their other recourse is going to be to a Jewish doctor? So good. I am not going to cause them to stumble. Instead, they're going to go to the Jewish doctor down the hall. And that one is going to cause them to stumble. Or maybe that one will refuse also, because he's a Jew and he knows what the law is, and therefore he is going to refrain from giving that advice. And in fact, in source number 8, the Mishnah Lamelech, in his commentary to the Rambam, raises that possibility, and he argues that if the alternative is a Jew, then in fact you wouldn't be allowed to provide this. And this comes up in various halachic discussions. The Chachmas Adam agrees with him. Rav Eliashiv sided with him as well. He dealt with a case of a Jew who is employed at a business, and his job as part of his work is to provide lunch to the boss. He has to go get lunch. And the boss wants non-kosher food for lunch. And the Jewish employee knows he's losing his job if he doesn't provide this non-kosher food. So he says, well, you know what? If I don't give it, the boss is going to get the other secretary, you know, person in the office, whatever it is, to go do it. So what's the difference? But the other one is Jewish also. So therefore, you're now back to square one. Because, number one, that other person may refuse. Number two, you, by refusing, are now leading the other one to end up providing it. Nonetheless, the Ksav Sofer, the son of the Chasam Sofer, as well as the Tzitz Eliezer, disagree. Sources 9 and 10 that I brought on the sheet. I'll just take you through number 10 quickly. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, this responsum that I quote here is a key responsum to see on this topic, because he deals with this issue directly. All the cases that I'm mentioning, he deals with them directly in his responsum on the subject. And he says, Rabbu aposkim acholkim ala Mishnah lemelech. Many authorities disagree with the Mishnah lemelech. V'sovrim she'inenu over ze'al lifnei iver. And rule that one doesn't violate lifnei iver, the prohibition against causing someone to stumble, even in this case. Because even if it's not him, he'll find someone else to do it. And And if it's not this Jew, it'll be another Jew, it'll be another, it'll be somebody who's going to do it. And therefore, Rav Waldenberg is in fact lenient. So the upshot of this is the first layer here is the prohibition of lifnei iver, of causing someone to stumble, will not apply if someone could have gotten the information or gotten whatever it is you would have provided somewhere else. That may be limited to a case where they can get it just as easily from somebody else as they can get it from you. That's one limitation to take into consideration. And also, perhaps, it's only where there's a particular benefit, but you can generally come up with a benefit. Coming up with a benefit in cases, especially once peace is licensed and financial gain is licensed, the benefits tend to be there. And as far as the concern that maybe they'll go to another Jew, the Mishnah LeMelech is concerned for that. Some halachic authorities are, but the majority of authorities are not concerned. So, if I were forced to answer this question, my inclination would have been, you're allowed to give that. Eddie?
But I see, almost like what this gentleman said before, that the lifnei iver not only not prohibiting you from doing it, but almost giving you an obligation to provide the advice, because if you withhold the advice, that's like providing the stumbling block. Because like you said, you know, they may not be abstinent, someone will get pregnant, and he said they'll either have the baby, or they may actually have an abortion.
Right. So hold that thought for one moment, please. I want to look at source number 11, and then I have to come back to that. Source number 11, from the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. This decision was clearly given a very long time ago. Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away almost 30 years ago, and he reviewed it. So you know that you're dealing with an earlier generation. How early is a good question? But this is available on their website. And their statement on the issue is, except under very exceptional circumstances, Judaism considers it immoral for the physician to give contraceptive advice to an unmarried girl. Comment, they write, the doctor must use judicious moral judgment in this sensitive area of human relations. Judaism deems it immoral to give contraceptive counsel to unmarried persons when such advice may serve to remove an important barrier to immoral conduct. When confronted with a mentally retarded patient or with people in whom self-discipline is lacking as determined by previous conduct, consultation with a religious guide should be undertaken to decide the proper course of action. And yes, the language that's used in that last sentence also indicates this is an earlier generation. The halachic authorities who are signed on this are very serious names. I am certainly not someone who could argue with Rabbi Tendler and with Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's no question. However, I would highlight a couple of phrases here. Number one, may serve to remove an important barrier to immoral conduct. The assumption really seems to be that there's a likelihood that because you didn't give the advice, they're not going to live together now. And so to go back to the question of what are you going to do when there's a baby, the assumption here is there isn't going to be a baby. It's either they're going to live together with your counsel, or they're not going to live together, which I think, in practical terms, today is not really a conversation. I think that's number one. Number two is that they stress repeatedly the word immoral. In their immediate answer, Judaism considers it immoral for the physician, further along, the doctor must use judicious moral judgment. Judaism deems it immoral to give contraceptive counsel. I wonder about how much of this is what you would call in halacha extrajudicial. In other words, that from a halachic perspective, it's permitted. You can justify it under the discussion we've just had about lifnei iver, but maybe still we don't think that it's a good thing to do. Maybe that's what's driving this.
What's the Hebrew word?
He doesn't. This is only presented in English. Yeah. And it's presented without footnotes. There's no, like, we're doing it based on X. It's simply a paragraph on the site. I don't know. But my sense in general is that we would follow the advice of Rick Waldenberg and say that it is, in fact, permitted. That's case number one. Case number two gets a little stronger. And that's the case of referring a patient for a non-halachic surgery, vasectomy, abortion, whatever it is. And the reason this is stronger than lifnei iver is what? What makes this stronger than the preceding case as a potential concern?
You're actually doing the act yourself.
Well, you're not doing the act, you're referring. But you are now a step in the process. Right? You are actually helping to move this forward in a way that providing information really doesn't. So that's why this is a greater concern. This is what we call misayeya. Misayeya, a Hebrew term, Aramaic perhaps, for assisting. What is wrong with assisting? So take a look, please, at source number 12. Commentary from Tosfos on the Gemara. He's talking about not assisting somebody in sin, and he says, "Va'afilu ma'iri shahayachol litlo, afilu lohaya biyado." He's talking about a case in which I have an object and someone from outside my house is going to take it out of my house on Shabbos. That's what we're talking about. And the problem being there's no Eruv, and therefore you're not allowed to transport from private domain to public domain or vice versa on Shabbos. That's the case he's dealing with. So he says, even if the person who was going to sin could have taken it himself, right, even though it was not in his hand yet, but there's no violation of Lifnei Iver involved because he could have reached in and picked it up. What's the difference between that and me putting it in his hand? Nonetheless, Mikomakom Iser Derabanan Miha Ika. There still is a rabbinic prohibition against me putting it in his hand for him to take it outside. Why? Shechayav Lahafrisho Me Iser. Because you have to separate him from violating the law. And what he means to say is, and he's stating this flat without elaboration, what he's saying is that there is a separate rabbinic prohibition against aiding somebody in doing something inappropriate, even if they could have done it without your help. Nonetheless, you can't be a participant in the act. And he says it's a rabbinic prohibition. The Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, writing in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah in the beginning of the Masechet, also says that there. Where does this come from? So one suggestion for where it comes from is that it's part of the mitzvah I mentioned in the beginning of Tochacha. I have a mitzvah of instructing people in proper behavior. If I am obligated to try to prevent people from sinning, I certainly am not allowed to help them to do something that I believe is wrong. And that's one explanation. Another explanation is brought by the Ritva, Rabbeinu Yontav Elashbili, in source number 13, in his commentary on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, in which he says that it's because of the principle of Arevus. It's the principle of joint responsibility. We are taught, as he puts it, all Jews are guarantors for each other. Kol Yisrael Arevin Zeh Bazeh. If one Jew sins, it's as though I sinned as well. And therefore, I am not permitted to do things that could, in fact, move a sin forward on behalf of somebody else. So maybe that's why I am not allowed to do this. But this comes up in all sorts of cases. It comes up, it's discussed in the case of a Jew who's going to help somebody else to write up a will that's going to thwart the Torah's pattern of inheritance. Leave aside the thorny question of kosher wills and all that. But the Gemara talks about lo teheve ba'avur yachsanta. The Gemara says one should not be involved in moving an inheritance from the person the Torah would have designated to somebody else. Because I am now aiding in the sin. So maybe here, under the rules of Misayeya, I should not be allowed to refer the person for that non-halachic surgery. That's the question. Everyone clear on the question? Yes.
But how does this differ from the previous discussion where you don't refer them, somebody else will refer them?
So maybe we're going to have to say that. That could be. Right now I'm saying the premise, but you're right. Maybe again the possibility of somebody else. I could respond though that even if somebody else could hypothetically provide the same assist, this is stronger because I am assisting them. It's more than just being a resource for information. I am moving things along. Let someone else move things along. Maybe this is worse than simply giving them the advice.
Okay, but in the first case, it's not just advice. You're also writing a prescription or something.
I think writing the prescription would put me in this category, would move me into this case. Yes. Question back there, Andrew? Okay, same question.
But getting the sandwich, maybe the non-kosher sandwich for your Jewish boss, isn't that the same as this one?
Yeah, I actually think yes. I think that it's stronger than the case of Lifnei Iver. Yeah, you're right. So, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg says, nonetheless, this doesn't apply in this case, and we have five reasons why this doesn't apply. Reason number one goes back to a point that we saw briefly hinted at in Rashi earlier. And take a look at source 14. And you'll see it there on the third side. Mishnah in Avodah Zarah talks about a prohibition that we have in the land of Israel. I am not permitted to process produce in a way that will cause it to become impure. It's a prohibition. So the question now is, I know somebody who wants my help in harvesting his grapes, in trampling them, in such a way that that impurity will be conveyed. Am I allowed to assist? So the Mishnah in Source 14 says, Yisrael shu oseh bitumah, if there is a Jew who is in fact processing his produce in impurity, lo dorchin v'lo botzrin imo, you're not allowed to trample the stuff with him. You're not allowed to harvest it with him. Avol molichin imo chavios legas umivin imo minagas, but you're allowed to bring barrels to the press with him that he's then going to fill with the wine. And once the barrels are full, you're allowed to take them away from the press with him. So you are allowed to assist, just not at the time when the prohibition is taking place. We are severely narrowing this rabbinic prohibition against assisting with the sin. And this is brought in numerous halachic authorities. The Netziv from Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin had a very difficult case. Rabbis come up with this all the time. His question was whether one would be allowed to officiate at a wedding between a man and a woman who aren't going to observe the laws of mikvah. That was the question that he addressed. And his answer, in part, was to quote this, and to say, you're allowed to assist others with their activities when it's not during the time of the Avera, not during the time of the transgression. So he said, I'm marrying them off. At the moment, they're not violating anything, and therefore it would be permitted. The Tzitz Eliezer quotes it, the Ksav Sofer quotes it, the Binyan Tzion quotes it, the Marsha, all the serious halachic authorities who dealt with this sort of issue in the last few hundred years have quoted this and said, it's only a problem during the sin itself. That's number one. Number two, what one is actually providing here is still a background step. The referral isn't the surgery. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Shlomo Mordechai Shvadron dealt with a very interesting case, the case of a landlord who was asked to rent out a store. Someone wanted to rent a store that he owned, and it was a Jew who's going to keep it open on Shabbos. And his question is, am I allowed to rent out the store? These are fantastic cases. Unfortunately, the last 300 years has seen, you know, the propagation of a lot of cases like this. But if you take a look at source 15, he says, "Va'od nira." It also appears, "De'bechol gavni de'ika mishum mesayeya haynu davka im beguf hadavar shanos in lachavero yase bo ha'iser." He says, "Mesayeya." This prohibition against assisting applies where the person's going to use the actual item that you give him for the prohibition. And he says, and this may sound a little bit like a stretch, but he says, the store, the physical land, isn't what's being used for the prohibition. It's just taking place in that environment. But the walls, the ceiling, that isn't what's actually being used for the prohibition. He brings in his own furnishings and his own equipment, and that's how it's happening. You're just providing the airspace, if you will, in which this will take place. I must admit that this sounds like a little bit of a stretch, but the idea of it, the idea of what you are doing as a background step, will apply in the surgery case. What you are doing is referring him to somebody else, but the somebody else is the one who's going to perform the surgery. That's not what you're doing. And that's a second reason why, halachically, authorities tend to permit. A third reason, it goes back to our point earlier about benefit, which is that you're doing it for your benefit, and that's also seen in a comment of Tosas, but we already saw this. But I'm sorry, in the comment of Ramban in source 16. I'm skipping the source inside, but you can see it there. And then, a fourth reason to permit is actually one that really requires its own extensive discussion. But in halacha, we have a category called mumar. A mumar is a Jew who has said, I am rebelling against halacha. I have no interest in being part of this system whatsoever. Not like I have a problem with a particular law, and not like somebody who said, this one thing, I want it so badly that I'm going to break the law in this case. Someone who has simply rejected the system and says, I'm not part of that anymore. And the rule, in fact, is that Tzitz Eliezer brings it from the Shach of Shabbos HaKohen in source 17, that when you're dealing with someone who is a mumar, who has dropped out, who has opted out, at that point, you have no prohibition against aiding him in sinning. He's doing what he's doing. He's playing the game himself. You're not assisting. It's going to happen anyway. It's going to happen regardless. And this person has taken himself out of the community. This is a topic that, as I said, deserves its own expansion and discussion. I'm really giving it short shrift by bringing it this way. But but it's an important mitigating factor that's quoted here. Not everyone agrees with this principle. It's actually, again, subject to quite a bit of debate. But that's a fourth point. And then the fifth point is, would you have to lose your license for this? And so for all five reasons, which I'm now going to sum up, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, and others permit you to do the referral for the surgery that's not halachically appropriate. Number one, because you're not helping during the transgression. Number two, because what you are providing is not the actual prohibition. It's just something that ultimately will lead there, but it's not the actual prohibition. Number three, you're doing it for your benefit. In this case, your license. Number four, you're helping someone, assuming that this is true, you're helping a mumer. It isn't always true, but if you are helping someone who has opted out altogether anyway. And number five, you wouldn't be expected to lose your license and your means of survival in order to avoid aiding this person. Yes?
Can you see the urologist who's doing it because of parnassa?
So that's the next case. The next case is direct assistance. Let me just ask, are there other questions on this first? Yes?
You're saying mumar. What about Tino Shishba?
So that's a really interesting question. Are we potentially getting bitten by our own kula in your argument? Which is, as Harold points out, we generally assume that someone today who is not observant of Jewish law is not a rebel against the system, but was never educated in the system. That's not always true. I'm sorry, let me restate that. That many Jews today who choose not to follow Judaism never really had a chance in the first place. Whether it's because they were never given a Jewish education, whether it's because they were given a bad Jewish education, whether it's because there was some terrible experience that turned them off, whatever it is, you know, whether it's the fact they looked around at the world around them and saw that God does not make himself visible, and they saw a Holocaust or whatever it was that said to them, this can't be real, and now they are a Tino Kshenishma. The problem with that is that by saying that, which is, we say that as part of an attempt to say, don't judge them, and, you know, and they're facing extenuating circumstances, maybe that means that they're not going to count as a mumar for this purpose. So it's an interesting question. Does the leniency end up leading to astringency? Even if I didn't have the mumar argument here from the Shach, I would still have all the other arguments. And frankly, as I said, that's the most contentious of the reasons given to permit. Not everyone even agrees with him in the principle regarding mumar. But it's a good point that mumar implies some level of will, like they knew the system and then they opted out. Right. Okay, the third case. The case of anesthesia during an abortion or counseling an intermarried couple. So this is the hardest one, clearly, of all of them, right? Because what makes this worse is the fact that you are actually the agent of the prohibition. Now, you're not the urologist doing the vasectomy. You're not the person doing the abortion, because then you have a question of your own potential transgression. Our discussion is not about your personal transgression. Our discussion is about helping somebody else to do it. So I didn't posit that you are doing the abortion, but that you are involved during the time of the transgression in something that is necessary in order for it to take place. Again, as I said before, not all abortions are prohibited within halacha. There are abortions that are acceptable within Jewish law. I'm assuming a non-halachic abortion. I'm assuming a non-halachic vasectomy. Otherwise, this question doesn't begin. So, there is basis here for indeed being more strict. Rav Avram Sherman caused a big fuss. Fuss is really not the right word; that trivializes it. But a very big problem in the world of halacha a few years ago. He's the head of a Beis Din in Israel, and he disqualified thousands upon thousands of conversions to Judaism. And he presented a very lengthy justification for his rulings. And one of his points was based on the position taken by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and by Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, which was, this is the argument, he said, if a judge on a Beit Din does a conversion knowing that the person he converts is not planning on observing Torah and mitzvot, then the judge is causing that person to sin. Right? You're taking somebody who wasn't Jewish, you're making them Jewish, assuming that the conversion is valid. You're making them Jewish, and now they're going to have all sorts of sins that they wouldn't have had if you had just left them as a non-Jew. Therefore, he argued, a judge who does such a conversion is guilty of lifnei iver, causing people to stumble, and therefore he is a sinner, and therefore all future conversions that he does are invalid, because he's not qualified to sit as a judge on a beis din, because he's a sinner. That was essentially one of his central arguments. I'm not going into the conversion discussion right now, but his point about lifnei iver is an important one, because take a look at source 18. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, no extremist he, says, Gam l'shitasam ha-megayrim osam, according to the view of those who convert such people who are not planning on observing Torah, over in Balav Shalifnei Iver, they are violating the prohibition against causing someone to stumble. In source number 19, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, I defy you to call him an extremist, says that a judge who's involved in such a conversion is in violation of Lifnei Iver. He is causing people to stumble. And so based on that, Rav Sherman says that the that where the connection is so close, it is indeed lifnei iver. He says, if this is, he says, I don't understand. I take a step back. He says, why is this lifnei iver? Why is this called causing someone to stumble? Why can't I say that if they didn't go to me, they were going to go to somebody else? Or why can't I say that I am assisting that person before the actual transgression? I'm helping in the conversion. They're going to do the sin later on. You told me that if it's not during the moment of transgression, then it's not called lifnei iver or misayeya. So why is this called lifnei iver? So Rav Sherman asked that question to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman's response was, I hear what you're saying, but it's still lifnei iver. And that's all that we have as Rav Shlomo Zalman's response. But he doesn't explain why. So Rav Sherman attempts to explain why in source number 20. And his argument is that there is a limit to the justifications we can offer to allow for lifnei iver. There has to be a point at which your assistance is simply too direct to say, well, it wasn't during the moment of the sin, or he could have gotten it elsewhere. There has to be a point at which you say, enough is enough. And he says that Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Cook were making that argument in the conversion discussion. I frankly find his answer difficult. I think the problem is real. Is it, how could it be called lifnei iver? But I think his answer that it's so direct, I think is troubling. Nonetheless, if I accept that statement, that where it's that direct, then the action is prohibited, then when we get to the counseling case, right? When we get to the case of, are you allowed to offer counseling to an interfaith couple? You are telling them, here's what you need to do to work on your marriage in order to stay together. Or when you say, I'm going to provide the anesthesia during the surgery that halacha does not approve, I think you run into a very real problem. I think based on his logic, that would indeed be prohibited. Nonetheless, the question was put to the Tzitz Eliezer, or Rebbe Eliezer Waldenberg, and he argued that nonetheless this would be permitted. And his argument that it would be permitted is simply that he goes through several steps, but one of his major points is, even if you're going to tell me that this is lifnei iver, even if you're going to tell me this is indeed causing someone to stumble, nonetheless, you are not expected to surrender your parnasa, to surrender your entire livelihood, to go lose your medical license for this. So if you have the option of getting somebody else to do it, yes, that would be preferable. However, you wouldn't be expected to lose your license for this purpose. That's his argument in the end. Yes?
In the question of a judge making for conversion, though, yeah, aren't they supposed to see that the person is a sincere convert?
Yes.
Like they're actually judging the person for the future. They're not just saying, well, you're at today.
Right.
So it makes more that they're converting someone who they know won't do things. They're not
They're actually derelict in their duty as a judge. It's an interesting argument. He doesn't make that argument exactly, but I hear you. In other words, what they're doing is effectively stepping off the bench by approving it. Interesting. I hear it. Yes? No.
What's the definition of iver in that situation?
In which case?
The situation of the conversion.
In the situation of the conversion. Because the person who's engaging in it doesn't actually think that failure to observe the mitzvos is going to have meaning for them in the future.
But then, you're mixing up definitions, because first of all, that individual in the conversion case specifically has already gone through a process of learning something.
Right.
Belief doesn't go along with it. They've learned something.
Right.
Therefore, by definition, they're not an ether.
Ah. So Albert raises the question, which I really ought to clarify better in the very beginning, of when we say not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, what about the knowledgeable person? What about the person who knows full well what's going on? So I refer you back to the shepherd. The shepherd knows full well that he's not supposed to steal. It's not that he thinks he's allowed to. He has a contract with the owner of the sheep saying all the kids go back, all the wool goes back, and so on. Nonetheless, for me to buy from him is called a function of lifnei iver, because I'm encouraging him to sin. He's not blind. He's not unaware. Nonetheless, anytime I'm going to cause someone to sin, where that person is tempted by some extraneous thing to go do something inappropriate, I am liable for lifnei iver. So yeah, I don't need the person to be blind.
Lifnei iver is almost as disabled. If you are disabled in your character, you can't control yourself, so to speak, and do something.
I suppose. Or it's simply an extrapolation from the case at hand. In other words, maybe what they're saying is that the biblical verse, do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind, is less concerned with the particulars of the case, the stumbling block and the blind person, and more concerned with an underlying theme of don't do something that's going to catalyze sin or enable sin, and therefore the blind element is as irrelevant as the stumbling block element. It's simply the underlying theme, maybe. That's what it is. Eddie?
The difference I see in the conversion case and the other case we're talking about is that if you're converting somebody who you don't think is going to be committed, you're putting a stumbling block in front of them for many, many sins, whereas we're just talking about one particular sin.
Yeah, it's interesting. You don't really see a discussion in the literature about the gravity of the particular sin involved. If we did, I would say yes. Yeah, I would say that this potentially is a far greater disaster. Frankly, though, I would put in the same category the Nitziv's case of officiating at a wedding where they're not going to observe mikvah. Right? So that's not just a one-time deal. That's going to be an issue also for years and years to come. And involving a fairly significant prohibition, at that. So it's not an isolated case. It is comparable to some of the others where we do say that it's permitted. But I definitely hear you about, yes, that is a more severe case, and it will also lead to other problems because of the possibility that the conversion is not recognized. That's a whole other field of problems. Jack?
Would that explain the reason why generally we only recognize Orthodox conversions over conservative conversions, because of the fact that
right. So there are many reasons why one particular conversion might be acceptable and one conversion might not be acceptable, but certainly you are correct that one of the basic principles is that we require an acceptance of mitzvot, and if the explanation of mitzvot to a person is you're allowed to drive your car to shul, you're allowed to whatever it is, then someone who says that's not part of the list is going to say, well, I don't, in other words, if I say you can't drive your car to shul, and someone else says you can, I'm not going to accept his instruction to that person, to the conversion candidate. So that would be a major bone of contention. It's not the only one. We have loads of bones of contention. Don't worry. But yeah, it's who informed them of the rules of membership, and what did they tell them the rules of membership are. So to summarize what we've said, and I apologize for racing a little bit because of the program at 10. That's really not the way I prefer to be doing this. That was my fault. But in terms of the first question, the question of giving the contraceptive information to the unmarried patient, so the core problem is causing the person to stumble, which we define as even if they're not blind, nonetheless doing something that's going to lead them to sin. And we said that prohibition will not necessarily apply if the information is just as accessible somewhere else. Limiting that potentially, though, to a case where you have something to gain, or there is some general gain to be had by your providing the information. And frankly, I would actually go back to the point that was raised about the baby and say that may be the gain that is to be had. In other words, the concern that if I don't give them the information, they're going to end up with a child who's not going to be raised properly, or God forbid, at all. And that may be the gain that justifies it. And then the potential limitation of can they get something of equivalent quality and availability and cost elsewhere? Because otherwise, what I'm providing them is actually, they don't have the equivalent of that somewhere else. And then the side note about whether it's going to be a Jew who's going to help them if I don't help them. But we saw the general permission, noting the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists and the statement that they have on their website, which may be informed by a different time when, if you didn't give them the advice, there was really a chance that they were going to be abstinent. Case number two, referring the patient for this surgery, so you are now a participant in the process. That's the concern for Ms. Sayeha. However, the Tzitz Eliezer and others argue that it's not relevant as a concern here. Among the reasons why is that you are not helping during the time of the prohibition. You are providing a background step. And then the third point, being the anesthesiologist during the abortion, counseling the intermarried couple, where your help is much more direct to the sin, there I think there is great reason to say you should really avoid being the one to do that, based on the point that Rav Sherman makes about your aid being much more direct. Nonetheless, the Tzitz Eliezer says that one would not have to lose his license because of the issue of misayaya, of assisting, and possibly even for the biblical prohibition of lifnei iver. One would not need to lose his license. Normally, I would have liked to spend some time on what also the code is for surgeons and for doctors and for medical professionals in general, under secular law, under Ontario law, what are the expectations? But I think you actually all know it much better than I do on this. But my understanding is that you are permitted to say that for ethical reasons you're not comfortable taking on a particular case if there is somebody else you can refer them to who will be able to provide them with what they need. That's my general understanding, but please make sure that you examine the rules yourself before acting on anything. Thank you very much. I will note two things, just momentarily.